tomorrow?
Normally, we have an available person.
We'll call the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Thursday, February 9th, 2012. We have a quorum, and would someone move the minutes from our February 1st meeting?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the minutes.
Representative Bannion moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. The first item on our agenda today is to have a presentation from the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. We have Director Coleman and Deputy Director Freeman. Welcome, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Terry Coleman. It's a pleasure to be here. And to my left is Jeff Freeman, the Deputy Director of the Public Facilities Authority. I want to give a quick brief overview, and then I'll let Jeff talk about our bonding bill request and basically how the Public Facilities Authority operates in conjunction with the other state agencies. But the Public Facilities Authority is basically a financial interagency entity. We have six state agencies that govern the PFA, with the Department of Employment and Economic Development chairs the authority. Commissioner of Budget and Management, your Management and Budget, Health, Agriculture, Transportation, and Pollution Control Agency. And we work with all those agencies in one form or another, various programs. The two requests that we have today for drinking water and clean water are primary partners in those programs, the Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We do have $1.5 billion worth of bonding authority, which for revenue bonding, which is totally separate from the state's credit rating. We are AAA rated by all three rating agencies for the clean water and drinking water revolving funds. And we are financially one of the stronger ones in the nation. We've got about $1 billion in bonds outstanding, so we still have capacity to operate that program. We're getting close to the point now where we're paying off bonds about as much as we're issuing bonds, so it's kind of a stable system there. Total assets of the authority is about $2.3 billion. So the debt-to-asset ratio is a little better than 1 to 2. We also cover all of our admin expenses based on fees for our loans. So whenever we make a loan, the repayments, we charge fees for those. When it comes to grant programs that are fixed percentages without a needs-based criteria, we charge a 0.5% up front to cover our administrative costs on grants. So we operate based on fees. We also finance with those fees the cost of the other agencies that do the technical work, Pollution Control Agency as far as the plan and spec review and developing the priority list. The Department of Health, we provide a little more money than just the fee revenues, but the federal grant we get from the Department of Health also provides operator training funds, wellhead protection money and things like that. So we provide those funds with the Department of Health to cover their costs associated with operating the drinking water program. So with that, our request here today is for $45,677,000. $17 million of that, a little over $17 million, is to match the federal grants on a 1-to-5 basis, both the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund and the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund. And with those funds, both state and federal, we issue revenue bonds to make loans, subsidize the rate. Our average rate this past year or two have been less than 2% interest on 20 and 30-year loans to municipalities. And then the other request is for the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, which is kind of that gap financing tool for cities that have fairly high costs and the affordability issues with the loan only. Use that grant fund with the state WIF funds to reduce the principal payment. We also have a partnership with USDA where they have a small loan and grant program as well. We match their grants. They determine a grant need, and we provide 65% of the funds the grant need out of the WIF program for them. And they take generally the very small, what we consider very weak credits, which would, when you're going to the market and selling bonds, they like to see a fairly strong loan portfolio. So the real small, low credit ones tend to be the ones USDA handles. They also have about three times the staff we do, so they can spend a lot more time helping those cities along, assuming their staff gives good advice. But, right, Bob?
Right.
We've had a couple cities in his district that had problems in the past, but they're cleaned up now. So that's it. I'll turn it over to Jeff and kind of explain how the programs work and how we decide how we fund projects and what our needs are.
Mr. Freeman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Jeff Freeman with the Public Facilities Authority. In your packets, you've got a handout that explains our capital budget request and some of the workings of the program, and I'll go through that handout quickly. As Terry said, the total request is $45,677,000. The number one priority for us, a little over $17 million, is for state matching funds to the federal grants, capitalization grants that come from US EPA for the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Funds. These are permanent revolving funds established under federal law where all of the repayments come back into the fund to support, first of all, to pay our bonds because we're leveraging these funds with PFA revenue bonds, and then to make additional loans. The dollar amount is based on the required 20% match to the estimated federal funds for the next 2 years. Looking back, the PFA has made on the Clean Water Program a total of $2.4 billion in loans, leveraging the $169 million in state funds that we've received. So there's a lot of bang for the buck there. Every $1 of state funds has generated approximately $14 in construction financing and over $3 of interest savings for the local government borrowers, because these are loans that we make at below market rate interest. The needs, we've done a lot of projects over the past few years. The needs list has gone down some. They're still considerable, approximately $280 million of needs on our project list this year, and the total PCA project priority list is $1.5 billion over a roughly a five-year period. PFA also provides some money, as you can see, to capitalize non-point source programs that are managed by other agencies. The Drinking Water Fund, you can see at the bottom of the first page, similar statistics, although it's a smaller program. It's been around for a shorter period of time, so the dollars aren't quite as big, but still significant leverage. Every $1 of state funds to date has generated about $10 in construction financing and $2 of interest savings for the local government borrowers, compared to what they would have had to pay if they had been borrowing in the private market. The second request is for the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program. This is the grant program that provides supplemental assistance for high-cost projects based on affordability criteria. There's two ways for cities to access the program. One is for cities that come to us through our Clean Water Revolving Fund Loan Program can receive a grant if their average residential household cost it exceeds 1.4% of median household income. With the latest census data on median household income, that would be a dollar figure of about $50 a month for an average household outside the metro area. Cities can also access the program, as Terry mentioned. We have a partnership with USDA Rural Development, the federal agency that provides grants and loans to smaller rural communities, and the WIF program can provide a grant match to the grant that Rural Development determines under their affordability criteria. The funding priorities for this program and really all of our clean water programs follow the PCA's project priority list, and we also focus heavily on ready-to-go projects. We don't make an award of any grant or loan until the project is ready to start construction and has taken bids. All of the money, there was $20 million appropriated last summer in the July bonding bill. All of the $19 million that went into the regular program has all been awarded or committed to projects that are either under construction now or will start soon this spring. There was $1 million for City of Albert Lea that, because it was under the program, the language doesn't quite fit, and I know there is a bill this session to and maybe up on this agenda to make a correction there to allow us to make that grant. Finally, the governor's capital budget includes a recommendation of $3.6 million that would to the Public Facilities Authority for a grant to the Lake Superior Poplar River Water District to provide water from Lake Superior for residential, commercial, and industrial purposes, including Lutzen and Mountains in that area.
I'll just briefly mention on that project, this is one the DNR has been after, the Lutzen Resort Area and National Superior Golf Course, to stop using the water from a trout stream because they're using water. So it's either kind of shutting down those businesses or getting water from Lake Superior, pumping it uphill for those purposes. So if you're familiar with that area, there's not much going on economically other than that resort and tourism business. So it's... To me, it's kind of critical from an economic standpoint to keep those businesses afloat. There's also about 100 residents up there that this will serve, plus some of the resort-related residential facilities. So.
The second sheet in your packet is just a summary of the loans made under the Clean Water Revolving Fund by year. It also shows the average interest rate each year, the average discount from the estimated market rate, and then our estimated interest savings that those loans have provided. There's a map on the bottom that shows how the money has gone to communities really throughout the state, big and small. The backside of that page, and I won't get into the detail, there's a couple of pie charts that illustrate the sources and uses of the Clean Water Revolving Fund, and I'll just point out there that on the sources of funds, the state dollars that are in the fund are right now about 6% of the total assets in the fund because of the federal dollars, and then the largest share of the PFA revenue bond proceeds that finance most of the loans. But the state share is critical in, of course, getting the federal dollars, but also in providing the equity into the fund that allows us to do that interest rate subsidy. So the cities can borrow the money at below market rates and generate that interest savings. The third sheet gives the same kind of information for the Drinking Water Revolving Fund, the loans by year, the average rate, the interest savings. And the backside of that page shows sources and uses of funds for the drinking water program. Again, in that program, state funds are about 8% of the total sources at this point. Then we get into a series of lists. The green sheets, for those of you who have the color copies, I think members all have those. This is the Clean Water Project Priority List, the full list as it's generated by PCA. Cities apply to have their projects put on this list. The PCA ranks these projects based on criteria that are spelled out in their rules. They're basically criteria, environmental and public health criteria that the projects are ranked based on. You can see the estimated cost for each project and the estimated funding from PFA programs in the middle section, and then the other funders that we coordinate with off to the right. The thing to remember, as I mentioned before, this is really roughly a five-year list of projects. It takes, these are complicated projects for cities to put together, and it can take several years to get through the planning and engineering and environmental review and really the local government decision-making too about how they're going to pay for it with the loan repayments back to us and other funding sources that they may be trying to apply for. So not all these projects are ready to go, and as I said, we only award money when the project actually is ready to start construction, has construction bids. The gray rows are projects that have been awarded. This list was approved in August or early September of last year. It runs on the state fiscal year. Under the PFA financing programs, you can see a section that says base programs, and the first column there is CWRF loan 2012 IUP fundable range. That's projects with the dollar amount there are the ones that are for our Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund. They've applied, they're eligible, they've completed the initial planning work, and they are working towards starting construction this year. The next column over, the federal funds that we get the last few years, they do have an allowance, actually a requirement for what they call principal forgiveness. Essentially, it's a grant to write down the amount of the loan. And under state statutes, the criteria for those funds are the exact same criteria as our WIF program. So it's an affordability-based criteria. And then the next group shows the WIF program, and that's our second capital budget request. The first column shows funds that have been awarded or reserved from money that's already been appropriated. The next column shows the estimated need that we've calculated based on information from the communities. We did submit a report to the legislature a couple of weeks ago, February 1st, by statute shows the estimated needs for all the communities on the list, and to generate that information we solicited requested all of the projects send us updated project information so that we could calculate that WIF need. You also see a cumulative column there that totals up that estimated WIF need as you go down the priority list. We generally consider that about for the top half of the priority list or so, really in terms of projects ready to go, it's about 50% of the list, because I said they're in various stages of planning and design work. So when you look at that cumulative column compared to the requested WIF amount, you can assume that we'll probably go about double the requested amount, because when that money is appropriated, we get it out the door very quickly to projects. We follow the priority order, but we're looking at which projects are ready to go, either through the Clean Water Revolving Fund Loan Program or through the USDA Rural Development, and you can see off to the right the projects that have applied for that program. So that's the review of what those green sheets are. Following the green sheets, there is a couple pages of alphabetical cities listed in alphabetical order if you're interested in trying to find a particular community on the list and where they're at. And it gives you the PCA, the rank, the priority rank there, which is matches to these green sheets, and then also the point value under the PCA scoring system. For our Clean Water Revolving Fund loans, our point cutoff this year and for the past several years has been 45 points. So projects that are 45 points and above that have completed the initial planning and are ready to go or working to go to construction are eligible to get on our funding list and get a loan as soon as they complete the approval process. Then you also have the blue sheets, which is the same kind of picture for the drinking water revolving fund program that we administer in conjunction with the Department of Health. Same kind of approach. Projects are ranked based on, really I guess it's all based on public health criteria for this list. The financing is a little simpler. The PFA manages the drinking water revolving fund loans. There is a principal forgiveness component, as I mentioned, on the clean water side. And again, we coordinate with other funders. I guess I didn't mention on the clean water list, the green sheets. We're not talking about them necessarily today, but you also see the programs that the PFA administers that are funded through the Clean Water Legacy Fund, specific programs, TMDL grants, phosphorus reduction grants, small community grants and loans, specific programs that are designed to provide assistance to communities that are being required to do something beyond or over and above the treatment that they would otherwise have to do in order for the state to address the impaired waters issues that the Clean Water Fund is directed for.
I'll point out one difference between the two programs. On the drinking water program, the one difference between that and the Clean Water program, Clean Water is most primarily municipal entities, sanitary sewer districts, stormwater districts, things like that, the public entities. On the drinking water program, anybody that has a public water source, that is 25 people or more have access to water on a daily basis, is eligible for funding. Rather than trying to make loans to private entities, what we've done with use the principal forgiveness is we provide 50% grants for those entities. There were roughly about 90 when we first started this a couple years ago, private entities that were on Department of Health's watch list that they've, I mean, their water literally was not safe to drink. So to operate those businesses, they had to bring in bottled water to serve clients. So we're slowly getting rid of that list, but providing 50% of the funding in grant form, so give health an easier time to enforce their activities without shutting the businesses down. A lot of them tend to be like healthcare facilities or daycare facilities in church basements out in the country, things like that. Some small resorts and trailer parks. So there's not a lot of wealth there to generate payments. So otherwise, they would have cleaned up their drinking water systems before then. I just wanted to point that out because you'll see some on the top of the page where the solution is like $4,500, you know, putting a new well or a commercial treatment package.
And Mr. Chair, with that, that's the end of our presentation. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, first of all, Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and gentlemen. I'd just like to comment on the general value that you perform the service to the state of Minnesota. And make the committee members aware of just one example of how the type of work that they do has impact. Those who've been around a while know that I represent, among other places, one of the largest dairy processors in Minnesota, First District Association. A few years back, First District needed to expand their operation. They currently bring in about 3.5 million pounds of milk each day. They want to go up to 7 million pounds of milk a day. And 6 million slices of cheese that will be increased. But in order to do so, the city of Litchfield had to increase its wastewater treatment capacity. First District is their biggest customer. They could not handle the increase. And through the work of the PFA and they did work with me on this and helped to make a change or here or there, maybe tweak laws here or there to make this work. And the city was able then to get the funding, expand their wastewater treatment plant. First District is now nearly done with their expansion, which has taken up two complete city blocks in Litchfield. And it's a really big thing that will be of great benefit not just to the area of Litchfield and Meeker County, but to the whole region and state of Minnesota because of their increased capacity and service. So thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Freeman, is
Representative Murphy, I think your mic is, thank you.
Is 45 the cutoff for the drinking water list, too?
Oh, I'm sorry. The drinking water list, the point value is a whole different scale. The cutoff for the drinking water list this year is 11 points. We had to raise it this year because of demand compared to fund capacity. So 11 points is the on the drinking water list.
For
But the scale only goes up to, I think, 35, where the clean water scale goes up to 100 plus. So it's really different scales.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I came in a little bit late, but to the testimony, so I'm going to ask about a specific project. I hope that's fair. It is on page, must be page 8. In the blue, and it's at the top, it's the Lake Elmo project, which is Representative Lomer's, but also we have that area in the East Metro with the 3M PFOA contamination, and it says it's an extension southwest area well contamination for $6 million. Can you tell me more about that project, and is that because of the contamination of the PFOA and PFOS, or
I can't tell you specifically about that. I can the ranking is done by the health department. I can definitely check on that. I don't know if it's a PFOS issue or there's something else. I'll have to get back to you.
I suspect if it was, it would have more points than 10. But we can get back to
that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slavik.
Yeah, thank you. And that's what, so then I'm, and I'm transitioning the ranking. So yeah, it's 10, so it's missing the cutoff, right? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. This year, as I said, our cutoff is 11. The cutoff is set each year when our board looks at, basically, it's a balancing of the current demand and the fund capacity. And then kind of projecting to the future to try to maintain a level of fund capacity into the future for future needs. So each year we're looking at that, and on the drinking water lifts, it had been, that cutoff had been down as low as 5 points for several years. It has been at 10 because of the demand and the high use of the fund in the past few years. We did raise it to 11 this year. But I'm hopeful that 10 is, maybe we can settle into 10 next year. It'll depend a lot on what the demand, how many projects go ahead this year, and then what we see for demand next year. But 10 is not out of the question.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, if I could. So that ranking scale, does that somehow encompass the severity of the need, or is it more indicative of where they are in the application or design process, if you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey. It really is the severity of the need. The PCA has criteria spelled out in their rules that are based on the environment, the water quality impact, as well as public health issues. And the same with the drinking water list. So that's really the ranking is based on that. And if a project is high ranked, but they're working through the various technical issues and they aren't ready to go in a particular year, they stay up at the top of the list with those points. And then the following year or whenever that project is ready, then they would apply and we would be able to fund them at that point.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-on question then, too. On the other funders section, my recollection is that most of these projects typically had some kind of a local match requirement, and yet your chart looks like very few of them do. What are the Very quickly, just what are the typical local match requirements, and are they reflected somewhere else, and I'm just not seeing this right?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, because we provide 100% financing, because most of the money, most of the financing that we provide is a loan that the cities repay with user charges or in some cases tax revenues or special assessments, but the loan really, I mean, you could say that's a local match to any grant funds that we would also give. But most projects are only receiving that low-interest loan.
There, with the exception, the Clean Water Legacy Fund, which are fixed grant percentages that the cities push, because they consider like the TMDL mandates when their permits are over and above the normal, the standard permit limits, because they're discharging into a water that's been impaired by these days studies. They wanted 50% grant to cover those increased costs. So there, you know, they have an option of coming in and getting a loan fund from us, or they can do the local match themselves. So the Clean Water Legacy Funds do require a local match, but that can be handled with a loan through the SRF if they rank high enough.
Mr. Coleman, to that point, who makes the determination as to whether or not Clean Water Legacy Funds are going to be used on any of these projects?
Okay. We have three programs. Because of the constitutional issue, we don't want to supplant existing programs, which is the SRF program and the WIF program. We looked at new mandates that are imposed on municipal wastewater treatment, either phosphorus, which is being imposed on a lot of systems now because that's determined to be a bad thing and being discharged. So cities that are required to reduce phosphorus below their existing permit standards, we provide 50% of the grant cost of that component when they expand the treatment. The other means is when the TMDL studies are done and impaired water is identified and the pollutant loads are targeted to various parties, and the municipality has to provide treatment, either stormwater or wastewater treatment to reduce the load that they're contributing to that water, we provide 50% grant to them as far as the money goes down. So it's based on priority order plus just the circumstances which cities face themselves.
Yeah.
That's kind of how we address the supplanting issue in the Constitution that just look at.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on that. As Terry said, and this is in the program statutes, each of these programs have the requirements and eligibility spelled out. And essentially for the TMDL and the phosphorus grants, these communities will do a project that may be a larger rehab of their entire treatment facility, but to meet the additional requirements from that TMDL requirement or the phosphorus treatment, there are specific components. There's a specific portion of that bigger project that's directly tied to meeting those additional standards. And the PCA engineers and the city consulting engineers, there's a lot of discussion to determines what specific components are related to that higher requirement, and it's only the cost of those that is the grant eligible cost, and then the 50% of that amount is how the grant is determined.
There is no loan program through Legacy. Representative Erdahl is not here, but
program is the small community, which is the ones usually under 50 households or less that have septic issues. And that program is a combination loan and grant.
Under Legacy?
Under Legacy, yes.
Okay. It gets a little confusing to me as to who's really making the decision here as to whether it does, in fact, supplant or not. And it seems to me that we keep going around and around. We had a discussion yesterday in capital investment along these lines. And I don't know how somebody can contend that a one-time capital grant is, in fact, potentially supplanting. It's not in the budget. It's a one-time capital grant, and yet people are arguing that in fact, may be supplanting by having that funded through legacy instead. It seems to me that this is not real clear.
Mr. Chairman, I totally agree with you for the most of the programs. Legislative auditor loves what we've done with our share of the legacy money because it's not, from a standpoint, we're just looking at something over and above what normally is required. So we only use the legacy money for, like I say, the phosphorus and the TMDL, and they've kind of said that's clearly not supplanting because that those are requirements that cities are forced over and above what normally they would have been required to do. So in that regard, we've kind of avoided that issue, but it is a has been an issue a couple of, especially in tight budget times, you know, when legacy money and general fund or bond proceeds fund the same activities, raises a lot of questions. It is problematic.
Thank you. Further question? If not, thank you very much, gentlemen.
We appreciate your support and moving it on.
The next stop for this report is the Capital Investment Committee, where some of us who are on that will have an opportunity to ask further questions about this. The next item on the agenda is House File 1830, and Representative Murray. Representative Murray, you want to move your bill?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. Yes, I would like to move House File 1830 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment.
Okay. You may proceed.
Thank you. We passed in last year's capital bonding bill a $1 million request to the City of Albert Lea. Shortly thereafter, we were notified by Mr. Coleman here that there was some problems with the language. So what I'm bringing forward today is just some simple language changes to make sure that we have this done appropriately. And so what we're doing here is that we're just asking that the language be changed in the bill last year that would exempt this project from the WIF requirements. And I think most of you received the information or the short paragraph on that. If there are some questions technically on this, Mr. Coleman has said he would be happy to explain this. Otherwise, it's a language change. It'll go back to the Capital Investment Committee and be ran with the bonding bill this year again. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Representative Murray and or Mr. Coleman. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, does this allow this isn't allowing Albert Lea to jump projects, is it?
Representative Murray?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, no. And this was a bonding bill that was approved last year, and so basically we're fixing some language in it to make it work properly.
Okay.
Further question? If not, Representative Murray renews his motion that House File 1830 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to capital investment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Murray.
Thank you.
The next bill is House File 560, Representative Downey. You want to move your bill, Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 560 to pass and be re-referred to the Environment Finance Committee.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll give a quick introduction, and then we have someone here from the University of Minnesota who can explain how they are using this program today. And I think that'll probably answer more questions than I can in my remarks or in direct response to questions. So if it's all right, I'll describe the bill and then let the university folks describe their program. So the purpose of this bill is to make available to any government entity across the state of Minnesota
Minnesota, what is currently now in law only available to the University of Minnesota and the Metropolitan Council. In state law, there is a generalized provision that allows government entities to purchase energy in kind of a forward mechanism, but only the University of Minnesota and Met Council in law are allowed to use kind of market-based tools and options that not only help you kind of lower your overall cost, but also create budget certainty. And so if you can think about a very simplistic concept of a government entity or a school board or whomever saying we'd really like budget certainty around our energy and fuel costs, and so you buy in advance. The problem with buying is in advance is you win some and you lose some depending on price fluctuations. And so the use of options and entering into the energy markets allows you to do that exact same thing, create the budget certainty, but also to mitigate the risk of winning and losing the cost of that. And so, again, I think our university testifier here can explain how they do that, and it'll be a little more apparent. But the basic concept is to allow folks other than Met Council and the University of Minnesota to do this same technique that those two have been using very effectively. The bill itself does a couple of things. The section of law that we're modifying is this generalized capability that's in state law, and you'll notice that we're actually repealing then the two specific areas in state law, one of which grants the University of Minnesota this ability and the other of which grants the Met Council this ability, and we're kind of upgrading, if you will, this generalized authority to all government entities to do the same kind of thing that is specifically provided to those two entities right now. So the change in the law is in and line 1.10 and 1.11, where we kind of redefine the definition of energy and allow unleaded fuel and electricity to be included in these energy forward mechanisms. In line 1.13, we actually allow essentially any government entity to do this. And in line 1.14, we allow this ability to use options in the markets as a way to do this as compared to simply just buying in bulk and hoping that you win on the energy price trend. And then down on page 2, subdivision 4 and 5, legitimate concerns would be that maybe smaller government entities that don't have high volumes, maybe don't have the expertise, would try and play in this game and maybe get caught up in playing the market. We've seen some unfortunate events out in California years ago where some of this happened. And so we want to have the necessary controls and make sure that this is a well-run, sophisticated process and that people aren't entering into it unnecessarily. One interesting observation, there was a provision in here previously that would have restricted this to individual units of government. And Representative Quam had a suggestion in our last, going into our last committee meeting that suggested maybe one way for smaller units of government, smaller jurisdictions to participate in this and gain the benefits without taking on the risk would be to join together in shared service type arrangements or kind of joint powers agreements or MOUs with another entity. And so we've taken out that kind of restriction so that they could actually band together and, you know, maybe local units of higher ed could use the University of Minnesota to help them with their program or something. So we're trying to kind of at least allow the shared services component of this to take place as well. So with that, I'm glad to take an immediate question if what I said was unclear. Otherwise, Mr. Chair, I think the university's presentation will kind of explain this probably better with a concrete example.
Seeing no immediate questions, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Bertelson. I'm the Associate Vice President for Facilities Management on the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota. First thing is to apologize that when Representative Downey first introduced us last year, we put together a short presentation, and he moved ahead quickly, and we didn't get it updated. So you're looking at a presentation that's a year old. I know that's true, and I apologize for it. I'll tell you where there's any differences that happened from last year. With that, just a short note, that the University of Minnesota is a significant amount of facilities. We have over 28 million gross square feet on the multiple campuses and research stations across the state. It's a unique campus facility. It's historic buildings, very technical, and facilities requirements. When we look at just the Twin Cities fuel use, one of the things, why did we start looking at this a number of years ago? Our projected use for fiscal 12 was 70% natural gas, a little bit of oat hulls, about 27% coal, and a little bit of fuel oil in case of we got restricted on natural gas use. And you can see kind of a sense of the volume and the fuel purchase budget. In truth is, with this particular year, our coal use has been downward, experimenting with which boilers we use as a primary and which ones we use as a secondary. So our actual natural gas purchase is even a higher percent. What's the implications of relying so heavily on natural gas? You can see the market volatility of natural gas over time has been really quite drastic. And as a public entity that has not varied, you know, has a predicted and pretty stable amount of revenue, what Representative Downey identified as price certainty and budget planning is a real critical component for us. And that led us to say, how can we work and manage our way through that kind of volatility? What we've put together for the last number of years is a natural gas purchasing strategy where our goal is to manage risk from a price volatility. We've established university protocols and an annual purchasing plan that established guidelines and purchasing decisions, so it identifies and ahead with oversight from senior leadership at the institution for staff like myself. We have a cross-functional team of people in our energy management, finance, our office of investment and banking, and myself, who are responsible for managing the program on a recurring basis. We also use market expertise, an outside contractor who works in this field exclusively, provides transaction execution, and provides weekly updates on what the market looks like, both kind of from a global perspective, where the trends, where the opportunities are. What's our outcome over the 2002 to 2009? When we compared our overall program compared to what if we had just bought all of our natural gas just on the spot market and just said paid whatever it was, acted retail, relative our plan versus that spot market during those years, 2002 to 2009, saved the university collectively $27.6 million. Now, it's certainly true that this last year, it works to save money more when natural gas prices are rising and bouncing all around when they've been plummeting, as they have during this current market. That diminished, in fact, some of the purchases we are paying slightly over. But those are still really quite small variances and have still maintained budget certainty. So I do want to be clear that there are times when you're playing for price certainty, and you hope over the long term, like any good investment strategy, that you've layered in appropriate strategies, and in the long term, you will win financially as well, but you certainly are gaining price certainty. That's the short kind of history and a few bullet notes on how we operate, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have an estimate of the administrative cost or the cost to run the program at the university?
Mr. Bertelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the only marginal cost would be what we pay our kind of market advisors on an annual basis, and I'm trying off the top of my head to remind myself what that is. Relative to the program, is very small. We're talking on an annual basis in small tens of thousands. So I think my memory is around 30,000 maybe a year for that market advice for the institution. But you have choices. We are also paying them. Included in that fee, though, is not just their advice. That we also have them do some other purchasing reviews and some transactional costs. So the advice part of it itself. But otherwise, it's just all internal staff that you have utilized.
Representative Winkler. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, the bill calls for internal and external oversight, but, you know, the university obviously has is much grander in scale as far as its finance staff and its facilities mm-hmm. management staff and so forth, and a lot of other government units don't have the size or sophistication that the university has. So I would imagine that there would be a lot of expertise that would have to be brought in. And I guess, and I think what's hard to weigh is whether the advantage of price certainty is worth the cost of basically administer or to deal with the hedge. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there's a cost to all that, I guess. And it's hard to probably compare the university example to, you know, the city of Edina, no matter how sophisticated it might be. And so I just try to get a sense of whether we risk enabling a lot of local communities to go down this path, perhaps with outside advisors coming in to sell services without having a good sense of what they're really gaining from it. Certainty, in your extreme case of natural gas and the amount that you're talking about, probably is worth some administrative expense. Other communities might not have that same extreme of dependency on natural gas or the wild fluctuations in the price. So it's hard to weigh those things out, and I guess I'm open to the idea, but I'm just worried a little bit that we're going to end up with a proliferation of these programs out there with people who aren't really good at doing it, and they might not really be a good deal for a lot of them.
Mr. Burleson, any response?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I probably will leave most of your comments to Representative Downey. I think from the university's perspective, we're not here neither lobbying for or against. We're for the legislation. Just to provide some feedback on how we approach the issue. And I think some of those same questions are ones that we evaluate and look at on an annual basis. I think what's important for me to maybe say real clearly, we've made this in a way that, and as a bill does too, that this is not an investment strategy. You know, this is strictly only about no more than what you would actually use. And I think the criteria or questions you're raising are true. And, I think I expect you could get some external advice probably for less than what we've chosen because of the amount that we use. But those are variables I think every organization you would need. But I expect your comments are more for Representative Downey.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I totally agree, and I think that's a big consideration with all of this. A couple of points. One, the bill is permissive, obviously. We're just making it available to other government agencies, and I guess the hope and assumption is that any government entity would do that exact analysis, as you described, to figure out whether it's worth it or not. The question of whether or not we're perhaps creating a little bit of an incentive for people to jump into something that they shouldn't be jumping into, that's a very legitimate discussion. Representative Atkins brought up those same points. I know I've had the same conversation with Representative Banyan. And the kind of oversight and governance section of the bill is intended to mitigate that risk. I am very open to suggestions for how we might even tighten that down further. Representative Banyan was talking about some specific techniques that we might want to exclude so that we're not incentivizing day trading or something like that. Representative Atkins and others have suggested that maybe there's a floor to the volume of energy usage that might kind of get you only up into the size entities that could manage it and really have a significant enough financial return. So I'm open to all of that. I guess part of the concern there is that we not do it in a way that smaller jurisdictions who maybe want to join somebody else who has the sophistication and the ability to do it, that we wouldn't kind of fence them out of it. But I'm glad to hear suggestions for how to improve the controls.
Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, my suggestion is more not so much the specific mechanisms, but the kind of oversight. And the two things that occur to me, or one that occurs to me first, is whether a report or a review by the state auditor would be a good place to do this. You know, I know we have some differences of opinion about the role of the state auditor for local governments, but at least it's specifying what the external review has to be. It could be a legislative report from each entity that does it, but I think it would be a good idea to perhaps be more flexible in how they approach it, but be very explicit about who they have to report to as they're doing it. That's just an option. I mean, I don't intend to throw a grenade by mentioning the state auditor or something, but They do have some expertise in this kind of area, and you know, or maybe it should be the Gambling Control Board. I don't know. But it seems to me that maybe we should be more explicit about how the external review and reporting has to be, and that it has to roll up somewhere at the state level.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
I just draw people's attention to line 2.12. The bill does specify that there be either an internal or external audit review. And I know there's a bunch of CPAs around the building today because it's MNCPA Day on the Hill. Maybe we can ask some of them out in the hallways how this would typically occur in a traditional audit and whether this would be included or whether we need something more specifically called out here in the bill. But again, I'm really open to working on that before this thing would actually get passed.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey. My suggestion is that there should be some state policy maker or state review of this. Whether it's a report or whether it's an audit coming from the state auditor or whatever it is, I think it should be information made available at the state level to policymakers to review this.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Bertelsen, interesting to read this. Why didn't the University of Minnesota believe in this when they decided to build the coal plant on the Mississippi instead of using natural gas?
Mr. Burleson.
Good.
Speaking of throwing bombs.
I know, Mr. Chairman, I know the answer is because you weren't there at the time. But
I was going to start there.
Mr. Burleson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I would defer to your greater expertise on this topic than my own, I think.
Well, the problem was that the people there didn't defer to it when they should have before they wasted the money in building the coal plant.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me first address the testifier. The bill that we have before us includes on lines 114 and 115 the ability to buy and sell options. So that we're beyond just looking at forward contracts. Can you just tell us how that additional authority would assist you in managing prices for energy at the University of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm frankly not sure exactly.
Okay.
At this point, we have not chosen to really get into the selling. There's the two ways you do the hedges, of course. One is a physical. So you buy it at a certain price certainty. The other is you maintain the existing gas delivery, but you do a financial hedge that's tied to that exchange.
Right.
I think the only place that we currently use it from a selling is when we, on occasion, have used that latter tool, the financial. So you, at the end, as part of the equation to balance it, you need to sell the financial hedge because you only want to receive one unit of gas, not two. So at our point, we don't buy it in advance with the intent to sell it. We buy it, or to undo that exchange. We've chosen not to try to get into very complex. We've chosen the simple sort of methodologies. So the only place that we have used the selling is when we've used a financial hedge, which then you have to sell. Does that make sense?
I hope so. Mr. Chairman, thank you. It is to me. I hope it's clear to others as well. I think I get that part. Certainly, when it comes to options, you want to be able to get in and out of the transaction. So you want both authorities, not just one. That makes sense to me. I also note that it's an expanded definition of energy on lines 110 and 111 here. Could you tell me whether the university would find use for those expanded list of energy products?
Mr. Burleson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, at this point we're not, as I can tell you. For now, we have focused exclusively on natural gas. Would that mean that we wouldn't do one of the others? I think our volumes of heating oil, propane, diesel at this point, unleaded, just are not major drivers for us and therefore not an issue. Which electricity is a more complex topic, we have not gone there. I think that market is a more complex one, and would we ever consider it? I not here to say we wouldn't, but it is an increased, dramatically increasing share of our cost. And so at this point, we're not, and that's not on our short-term time horizon.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just then a comment, and Representative Downey already alluded to conversations we've had about this. The oversight mechanisms that were discussed in Subdivision 5, I think those were the ones that Representative Atkins put on the bill when we were in higher ed. I liked those, but as we indicated, we're still thinking that there may need to be more than this. I like the idea of having some permissive language, having some flexibility to this, but I'm glad we're moving to another committee to perhaps flesh out more what those will look like. But I'd also want to think about you know, who's going to be using these options, who's going to be using the broader list of energy resources you're talking about, and would hope we could have examples. You may already have those, Representative Downey, of who else might want to have the ability to trade directly in the electricity market as opposed to buying a more physical commodity like natural gas or coal. I'm done.
Other questions? Representative Downey, with respect to the oversight process question that was raised here, do you have a particular thought as to how you want to handle that issue? I mean, if we send this on to Environment Finance, they may or may not be the appropriate a committee to consider any change in that, and so that's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, off the top of my head, as I was listening to Representative Winkler's comments, one idea I had, and it could be done as a quick oral amendment, although we might want to give it a little more thought than just doing it on the fly, but would be to, on line 2.12, after the phrase internal or external audit reviews, you could just insert a quick phrase as prescribed in a form prescribed by the state auditor, which would allow the state auditor to define kind of a standard way to report and review these things. That might get at the core of Representative Winkler's comments and allow us to move this on comfortable from this committee. If people still have a level of discomfort, I am very happy to bring it back through this committee after energy. And maybe just a quick comment there. This question of electricity being included or excluded is an important one. I've had some of the retail electric folks advise me that this could allow larger energy consumers to kind of go around the retail side of it directly to the generators. And I don't understand how all that works when you start to trade on energy or electricity futures. So that's part of what we'll explore in energy. So there's still a couple of little unanswered questions here, and I'm glad to bring it back if the committee feels that that's important. But if folks, I'm seeing some nodding of heads, if folks are okay, I'd at least do that oral amendment here today and see if that maybe gets it past the point of concern there.
Representative Winkler, do you want to comment on the suggested amendment?
Mr. Chair, I think that is a good place to start, and I'm sure if we do that, we'll probably hear more from the auditor or from others about whether that makes sense, but I think it's good to insert that concept and take it from there.
Okay, Representative Downey, do you want to offer that amendment, that is an amendment then?
I would, and I, as per usual, saw Mr. Shepard writing down the language that I offered. If he wouldn't mind maybe just rereading it for the committee before we
sure.
put that to a vote.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, I would suggest on page 2, line 12, after reviews, and I'll write this down for Mr. Glessing, after reviews, insert in a manner prescribed by the state auditor, and I use the word manner instead of form so that it doesn't imply it's a paper type form.
Thank you.
Representative Downey?
So moved, that oral amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Discussion on the oral amendment. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Any other discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Downey.
And I don't know if you want to
state this now or not, but I guess I am glad to bring this bill back to this committee after it goes through energy, if the chair would like, or if the committee members feel that's important. So,
Representative Downey, I think if issues come up beyond what we've talked about here that really would be best to run through this committee, then I think we'd better keep that open as an option. But the amendment that we just adopted clearly is the jurisdiction of this committee, and it would be best to have that amendment here rather than in another place. So if after you get through the discussion in Environment Finance, you feel that it should come back, why don't you ask them to re-refer it back to us? Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, would you assume in this that maybe some of the smaller users, a Richfield High School, Albert Lea, some small agencies would maybe kind of band together to do some of this, maybe through a co-op or work together a bunch of different schools or agencies to try to accommodate this or work with this?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murray, short answer, yes.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, we in the Energy Assistance Program in Human Services, I believe it is, they did this with propane because in the late summer, early fall, propane is substantially cheaper than it is in the wintertime. So they were anticipating saving a lot of money, and I was the author of the bill, and unfortunately they lost money the first year, but it's worked ever since then. But when you look at this stuff, anybody can do this right now. They don't need a bill passed for it. It's perfectly legal, and I look at this chart. If I was a gambler, which I sometimes am, I think now's a great time to buy natural gas futures. It's pretty low. I don't think there's a whole lot of gambling right now. So it's nothing really new, but
Mr. Chair, if I
Representative Downey.
Yeah, and your points are well taken. Actually, the idea for this was brought to me by somebody who does do this in the private sector on a variety of fronts, and does have some public sector clients too around the country. And what he brought to me a year ago, which is when this bill first originated, is that there are many units of government that are hesitant to engage in this because state law specifically says that the University of Minnesota and Met Council can do this, and so they infer from that that you need to get explicit permission from the state to actually do this. So I think your point is well taken. Probably technically they could go out and do this if they wanted, but we're just going to kind of take away the potential inferred impediments as the way it's written in state law right now.
One follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I think ISC Financial Services, under Representative Murray here, can start a new business.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, this is a very highly specialized field, so if Representative Murray has that expertise, I wish him well.
You better not vote on it, then.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to recuse myself here, and I'll probably just stay to ETFs and mutual funds. So.
Okay, so noted. Any further discussion? If not, Representative Downey, you want to renew your motion?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd renew my motion to pass House File 560 to be re-referred to the Energy Finance Committee, Finance Committee.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Representative Downey and Mr. Bertelsen. And the next item on the agenda is House File 1850. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1850 be passed and referred to the General Register.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the gain-sharing
program that we passed in the state government finance omnibus bill as negotiated in the final budget agreement with the governor. And during that negotiation process, you'll notice on line 1.17 of the bill, there was a cap put on the size of the gain-sharing awards that could be offered at $1,000 per individual and $2,500 per group. We had some discussion at the time about whether that was the right number. In my mind, too low by a long shot. But absent dragging budget negotiations into this kind of an issue, we just left it sit, and I'm coming back now and would like to up that upper limit to $250,000. And the reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is that what we want to try and do, I think, is incentivize people to really look for big opportunities to improve what we're doing and find savings. And frankly, when you look at some of the big initiatives that we're asking our state employees to participate in, an $80 million implementation of a new accounting system that, you know, literally can save tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of operational dollar costs over the years. I know in the OET consolidation, I think I heard that we've already saved $600,000 just by having folks purchase off of the state IT contracts. And in a lot of those cases, you know, we're passing laws and management is just doing what they're supposed to be doing and doing a good job at it. But what we'd like to do is make sure that there's a big enough potential incentive out there that people who are just doing their jobs every day, looking for ways to do them better and kind of getting outside the box and thinking big, would actually have a chance to see a substantial enough reward that they would do that. So there's nothing that says you have to have an award that's this big. It just says that at the upper limit, $250,000. And you may say, wow, that's a really huge number. But boy, if somebody comes up with an idea that can save us, you know, $10 million a year or something like that, or if you have 50 people working on some massive IT project that's going to save us, you know, hundreds of millions over a biennium or something, I don't think this is an unreasonable amount, and I'd really like to have enough money available to the commissioner to have the right incentives for the right size projects and to reward people for really big ideas.
Discussion through the bill. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, which commissioner are you referring to?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gauthier, the Commissioner of Management and Budget was instructed to develop the gain sharing program.
Okay.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to talk about the $250,000. It does seem, wow, it's a lot of money. But I think I'm just going to let that go. Leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Slava.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey. Wow, it is a lot of money. $250,000. Authored the False Claims Act before Representative Steinem was able to pass the False Claims Act, and that's where you have whistleblowers that are getting amounted or, you know, rewarded for whistleblowing. So it's more of a risky situation. I just think of how do you determine whose idea it was, and intellectual property and, you know, all of those types of things you think of. So who actually gets the reward? And just Representative Downey, how is there a process laid out? I mean, I guess we're still learning about these bills that were passed after the shutdown and during the special session and trying to figure them out. But what's the process? How do they determine whose idea? Is it kind of a stake in the ground? Do they write a memo, it was my idea? Or how does this work?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is the purview of the Commissioner of Management and Budget, and I would hope or anticipate that at some point in time, you know, maybe during this session, we'd get a report back and see their progress on that. I would say most private sector companies that I've been a part of have some kind of employee suggestion and reward system, and there's some controls on that. You'll notice that in the language we passed last year, down on line 1.20 through 1.23, the purpose here is not to offer some kind of a reward system to employees whose very justum, and there's some controls on that.
You'll notice that in the language we passed last year, down on line 1.20 through 1.23, the purpose here is not to offer some kind of a reward system to employees whose very job it is to do these kinds of things, but to people who are really thinking outside of the box, or people who are just performing a function or a task and they have some insight and can bring it to the table and make a difference that would never have been made if they hadn't made it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slaw.
So it is an interesting idea, and you think if there, I'm sure there are ways we can be saving money in state government. And it will be, so my understanding is then it's going to come back, and then you're going to have a report on who does this. Where does the, does the commissioner set aside $250,000 that sits in a fund, or where does the money, I guess it, we wait till it's saved, which could happen over a number of years, and then they get the money, or sort of how does that work?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, again, if the language that we passed last year says that the maximum award would be 10% of the realized savings in the first fiscal year. So presumably all of the payments that would be made under this program would have been through savings to whatever fund the savings came from. So there was not a fiscal note on this particular provision, and I don't think there would be even under this change.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the money's paid out of the savings as prescribed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Further questions? If not, Representative Downey, do you want to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'd renew my motion to pass House File 1850 and have it referred to the General Register.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is passed and sent to the General Register. Members, our next meeting, we will have a presentation from the Minnesota Historical Society on their bonding priorities, and then we'll have presentations on several bond requests, non-water related, that have been sent to our committee. So that's the plan for next Tuesday, the 14th, Valentine's Day.
My wife's going back from Florida.
All right.
That day.
With that, meeting adjourned.